Oh, yes. In 2022, when there was $7 corn and I was out baling hay, absolutely. I would, as I turn the tractor around and see the ethanol plant on the, as I'm driving by, I'm questioning, what am I doing out here? I could be grazing corn. I look at it from a diversity standpoint. Ethanol is a part of agriculture, but this other part of agriculture, the grazing, the livestock end of it, that should also be a part of it as well.
Welcome to the 357th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. Talk about market accessibility. In case Alan and Kathleen Deitz ever need a reminder of one of the main reasons corn dominates the landscape in their part of southwestern Minnesota, they need to look no further than the massive ethanol plant that rises to the sky just across one of their fields. The Deitzes farm some 800 acres in Lyon County. The land is just on the edge of the city of Marshall and lays as flat as a billiard table, making it prime corn growing ground. So yes, they do raise corn, and yes, much of it goes to that Archer Daniels Midland ethanol plant just up the road. But in biofuel's massive shadow, the Deitzes are going against the grain, literally. About half the acres that make up their operation is planted to crops for the organic market. The Deitzes raise not only corn, but wheat, oats, and sometimes barley on these organic acres. But perhaps the area where the farmers depart most dramatically from the corn-centric economy of the region is in their use of rotational grazing to produce livestock. They have a cow-calf beef herd, as well as a flock of hare sheep. Goats and hogs are also part of the mix at Redwood River Farms, which direct markets meat to customers. All those animals are raised on rotationally grazed paddocks, planted to summer annuals, among other things. They also graze a local Minnesota Department of Natural Resources wildlife area. The Deitzes dairy farmed until they sold the herd in 2016, and reintegrating animals onto the land hasn't been easy. For one thing, they had to set up a significant system of fencing, which they were able to do with the help of such initiatives as the Natural Resources Conservation Service's Environmental Quality Incentives Program. At first glance, not taking full advantage of a handy local market for a crop that grows well on this land may not seem to make sense. But the Deitzes have some good, nuts and bolts reasons for not going whole hog into growing corn for biofuels. Alan has a master's degree in economics and teaches ag business at Southwest Minnesota State University in Marshall. So he knows how to crunch the numbers and do financial projections. He sees livestock as a way to diversify the farm's income stream while providing a kind of insurance policy that fortifies them against crop failures, something that's become particularly critical in recent years as climate change churns out extreme weather on a regular basis. And diversity helps safeguard a farm's viability when corn prices plummet, as they did in 2024. In addition, rotational grazing bolsters the soil's long-term biological health, building up a bit of a bank account that can be cashed in when annual crops are planted. During a recent field day sponsored by the Sustainable Farming Association and the Department of Natural Resources, the Deitzes provided a tour of their fields and grazing paddocks and explained how they're using the livestock not only as a source of income, but as a way to transition acres into organic production. Afterwards, with the lights of the ADM ethanol plant twinkling in the dark on the other side of the Redwood River, I talked to Alan about the value of diversity, the benefits of reintegrating livestock onto the land, and why he and Kathleen are leaning more in the direction of perennials. He also talked about how it isn't always easy to experiment with regenerative farming methods as farmers from across the region haul corn right past his fields to the ethanol plant. The farmer started our conversation by describing the crop livestock rotation history of a 40-acre field we were sitting near.
We just had a field day, and you did a really nice job of taking us to different parts of the farm, different fields, and doing a little history on what you're thinking of, because I think one of your main messages was you have to think about this on a multi-year level, and you can't just go from year to year. You're thinking more in the long term and trying to integrate soil health into that type of thing. So the first field that we looked at here, I think it's a 40-acre field. Take us a little bit through the history of that. I think that was a really good example of you kind of having to think in the long term and also really roll with the punches a little bit with weather and other things that kind of come in on that.
Yeah, so that first field we went to was organic wheat this year. It was a 40-acre field. Where we're at right now, it ended up being actually my most profitable acres this year from what I'm seeing. I had roughly around a 53-54 bushel average on the organic wheat. Had it tested out, and it did make a milling quality. So that was a nice little bonus on top of that. So it ended up turning out really well, which was nice after the kind of the history, which I'll get into now. But that field was the first one of the first fields that I converted over to organic. We did that by planting it in perennials. That was a decision I made. That was how I was going to do it. A lot of farmers, when they end up switching over to organic, they'll end up planting alfalfa stands. That's a pretty common way to transition over. I knew I wanted to be able to graze this and have some diversity in the mix. And so I worked with, I believe it was Millborn Seeds, Justin Fritchie over at Millborn Seeds, and helped me develop a mix that worked really well. It was with Timothy Meadow Brome, some fescue. There was a couple other in the mix for the grasses, and then it had in some clovers and alfalfa. And that ended up being a really good grazing mix and a hay mix. So we ended up grazing and haying that for we had a nurse crop on 2018, but 2019 we ended up haying and grazing that, 2020 all the way up until 2023. 2023, knowing that after being in organic for that long, or being in hay ground for that long and passed its organic certification, I looked at it from a cash flow standpoint that maybe it was time to pull this out of perennials and cash in on the bank account or the savings account that I have accumulated with the perennials there by building the soil out, I should say. And so it seemed like the time to do that. So what we ended up doing that year is actually calving out on that piece. So we actually grazed off the first crop and had our calved out there. Worked out great. The cow calves were did well. It was just, since it was so close to the farm, just made a lot of sense. It worked out really well. And we ended up finishing up calving, or close to finishing up, but we moved the cattle off so then I could do a spring plowing. Spring plowing is sometimes tricky from what I've heard, but the conditions were right at the time. It was fairly dry and everything kind of looked good. So I went ahead and made my first pass through the field and somewhat regretted it because I didn't want to see those perennials be plowed up, but then I also knew why I was doing what I was doing, so I continued on, and it was really nice. There was really great aggregates in the soil. I was really, really excited to see how this was going to turn out for a corn crop. I ended up going over with the field cultivator one time just to kind of level out the field, and then went in with a planter and planted. It seeded really nice. The unfortunate thing that ended up happening was between roughly about May 10th to September 20th in 2023, my farm location there ended up with about 3 3/4 inches of rain during that time. And so we did not get enough water or moisture in the soil to get it started. That late plow, probably grazing off that first part, and then being, it was also very hot and dry when I plowed. I think it got up to 90 degrees at that point. So it kind of baked the soil a little bit as well. So we ended up in a situation where we planted, but we didn't have enough moisture to germinate the seeds. Over that time, that 3 3/4 inches, I think we had one rain that was a half inch, and that came in July sometime. Otherwise, it was a tenth, 2/10 at a time. Not enough to connect the seed and the soil together. And so we ended up having just an awful stand out there. That awful stand, it was probably 20-25% stand, and at that point it was just not going to be a viable crop. Checked with crop insurance, make sure that I went through all the proper channels to make sure that worked out, that we were all on the same page. And then at that point, I made a decision to leave a check strip and graze the rest of it off using cattle. That ended up working out pretty well to do so because they kept the weeds down in those acres. They processed through that corn, and we really didn't end up taking anything off it besides what the cattle took off in gain. So, and then they processed all of that excess forage and put it back in the soil. And so that was kind of the lead up to the 2024 crop, which ended up being, like I said, we had a very, very dry winter. So going from a very dry summer to a very dry winter, I wasn't quite sure how things were going to look going into 2024. I ended up deciding to put that in wheat. We were lucky enough to get it in fairly early. I think it was April 7th is when I got it in this year. And it was right after we had some rain. I contemplated with the dry spring that we had, I contemplated planting it right around the 20th, 21st of March, but I chose not to because it just seemed too early to do so. And then luckily it rained for a couple weeks, so we did have some moisture when I planted into it, kind of prevented me from making a bad decision of planting too early, I guess. But then I was able to get it in on April 7th, which was really nice. It was I got it in and we got a nice little rain on it afterwards, so it took off from there. The field ended up taken off fairly well through the season. Due to the drought last year, we had a real bad bloom of Canadian thistle that popped up through the low spots. With the spring that we had, it ended up being a wetter spring than anticipated. That kind of perpetuated, which kind of perpetuated the problem in some of the areas. So the real wet spots on the farm ended up having a lot of Canadian thistle. So as we were going through the season, I wasn't quite sure how it was going to end up. We went out there and tried to do some walking to try to top some of those thistle heads off. That was the only really issue we had from a weed pressure standpoint. Yeah, and then other than that, we ended up, some of it just kind of got away from us because of the moisture, and so we kind of let it go at that point. And ended up harvesting it this year, and it turned out to be a fairly good crop for organic wheat, so we were happy with that.
I think this is a really good example of, you were talking about how when the corn crop didn't work out, because you had livestock, it's almost like an insurance policy. You were able to bring them in and get economic value out of that corn crop while bringing in their manure and adding fertility to it. I mean, I think that's a really, if you didn't have that livestock, if you hadn't put in fencing systems and that kind of thing so you could graze it, you wouldn't have had that option. It would have been a failure, and you wouldn't have gotten that economic value. Plus, you wouldn't have maybe been building that soil health up for the future a little bit.
Yeah, it ended up working out. It worked out pretty good. You know, working with my crop insurance agent, making sure that I was going through those proper channels to do so, we were able to graze it. And so at that point, what was going to be kind of a weedy mess and sporadic corn crop, we were able to turn that into some value by running the cattle and maintaining it. With an organic system, you're limited on the tools that you have in the toolbox. You can't necessarily go out and spray weeds that are down, and you don't necessarily want fallow ground sitting there. So having the cattle run over it was a great option. And then, yeah, it was a good point that you brought up with having the fencing. Particularly where I'm at, it's a very heavy corn and soybean region, and a lot of the fences have been taken out over the years. And there's just not a lot of farmers that have the ability to run cattle. Even if they had cattle, they'd have to replace all the fences that they had. So I'm glad I started building in that infrastructure, because it ends up giving me those options, as you said, as an insurance policy. And with those fields, it kind of makes them more dynamic at that point, too. I'm not stuck in a rut where I have to go corn or soybeans in my rotation or just row crops. I can mix in cattle on a hay crop. I can do an annual cover crop, an annual pasture, I should say. All of those things are options that I have by being able to do that. And it's especially important with the climate that we're in, because it'd be nice to get a normal year, but really over the last, I go back to 2018 when I started the organic transition, there really hasn't been a normal year from a historical context. On our home farm here in 2018, we had the river crested twice, which flooded over into our farm, once in July, once in September. 2019 was the year where majority of Lyon County was in prevent plant. I think only, I'm going to inverse these numbers here, but I can't remember if it was 60% of the crop was not planted or only 60% of it was planted, but of the corn crop. So most of it was in prevent plant that year because it ended up getting so, because of the moisture we had. 2020 started out really wet, but then dried out and turned out to actually be what we would consider more of a normal year, I guess, because it was more of a normal cropping year that way. But then we had 2021, 22, and 23 where we saw drought. You might not have necessarily saw it to the same effect on the corn and soybean for corn and soybean farmers, but if you were had hay or pasture or any of the other crops, you saw the effects of that that drought that hit. So, and then this year we had what was looking like a drought coming into the season, and then turned out to be a fairly wet May and June. So, and July for that matter as well. So it's just with kind of the erratic weather system that we've had, it gives you some resilience and some options when things don't go the way that you're anticipating.
Talking about the fencing and how you were explaining earlier, so we can see literally from your farm the ADM ethanol plant here, and that really had a big, I don't know when you said that went in. And
it was built in the mid-80s, and what that did in this area really had a really big economic impact on corn farming. It used to be historically there, Lyon County here had a fairly low corn price because there wasn't a lot of options to move it out of here from an export standpoint. Yeah. So it was definitely a value added at that point. But yeah, so having that there kind of it did change the landscape a little bit because it seemed like a lot of the farmers in the area, because of that basis improvement, decided to get out of livestock, which, you know, is their prerogative on what they want to do, and it made economic sense. But I still, being a former dairy farmer and still having cattle, I think it is important to still have that livestock connection on a farming operation. Historically, that's always been the case. Domesticated animals have been included in farming since farming had started, and you know, there's a good relationship that happens between having the livestock and the ground and the soil. When we take those out of it, there's something missing at that point.
Well, the other thing that really struck me is we went a mile north of the farm here to another farm that you farm, and I think you said it's 175 acres or
170
acres. You've been establishing some summer annuals and some stuff there that you're grazing there. But one of the things you pointed out was the cow pies. I think this was a really important point that you pointed out. You said the cattle are bringing something back to this. I think that's an important thing to look at is that when you are using the cattle, it's even different from maybe taking hay off. You are returning something back if you're doing a good grazing management system.
Right. Yeah, and so with that field that we looked at, I planted a summer or annual pasture is the way to look at it. It was a combination of wheat, oats, and barley, just some crops that I raise on the farm here. And then I purchased some field peas. I think I had some common vetch, and what was the last part of that? Buckwheat. Mm-hmm. So I mixed that in there, and with the intentions of grazing that. You know, it might look a little funny to some individuals where the only economic value that I'd end up getting off of it this year would be running cattle over it. But I'm looking at it from a long-term perspective. Next year, I'm hoping that's going to be an organic corn crop, and they're basically applying all of my minerals, my fertilizer for next year, all the nutrients that I'll need for that crop, they're applying out there. So whereas I might not necessarily make as much money, or you know, I'm hoping to have a break even on that field this year. Next year, I'll see the value of that when we pull the organic corn off of it, because the amount of nutrients that I had to apply I'm not having to buy any botan inputs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's kind of the big advantage that I'm seeing. So even if the crop ends up only being 100 bushel of organic corn, that's still going to cash flow because of the low inputs that I have into it. So I think that's kind of the big thing that they add into it. And then too, I think from a fitness standpoint with the cattle, I think it's good for them to be out moving around on the land. There's just, you know, that's where they need to be. It's out on the land versus, you know, in some sort of barn or in a yard or a lot. So. Yeah.
You just have to put up with the peer pressure of, because the ethanol plant is right there, like you said, everybody's driving by, hauling their corn to the ethanol plant. There's probably one of the most trafficked areas in the county. and everyone go, and you're like, oh, what's Alan doing now? Yeah. There, so something you have to kind of deal with a little bit.
Yeah, I've noticed it from a few neighbors that they'll say something about, you know, and they usually have, you know, it's the Minnesota Nice thing. They'll say something when something goes right. They'll say, "Oh, that worked out pretty good," or "That was kind of neat to see." And so I know people see it, yeah. And so which is it's a double-edged sword at that point where, yeah, it's good for, you know, to see something, a little variety out there, but then also when something fails, it fails spectacularly. And you know, the joke I have is, you know, every farmer in four counties drives by my farm at some point, it seems like, because of my location. So whether they know it's me or not, they still see what's going on out there. That was a tough one last year with the organic corn failure, just having that look the way it did, and knowing that I was grazing it, knowing that I had a plan, like I understood what I was doing. I understood it made economic sense on my end, but from the casual passerby seeing that, it didn't look appealing. And that was the same thing that happened this year with the wheat. I had the thistle bloom that ended up in those wet areas. And I knew it didn't look good, but I knew how good the rest of the crop looked. And I knew what the numbers were on it, that yes, I don't want to have those thistles. Yes, I want to try to do what I can about it. But on the other end, from an economic standpoint, it was going to make sense. And, you know, it's part of my farming operation.
I think that brings up another really good point that you brought up, which was your off-farm job is you teach, is it ag finance?
Ag business
at Southwest Minnesota State University. You're used to looking at finances and thinking in terms of numbers and that kind of thing. And one of the points that you made was it's a little bit frustrating that building soil organic matter is not one of those things that really shows up on a balance sheet, that's really hard to tabulate in and say, okay, maybe I'm not getting a top crop this year, but I'm still, because I'm integrating livestock into the system and kind of building that soil health, I am over time kind of building up the financial resiliency of this soil here. It sounds like that's something that you think about a lot.
Yeah, and you know, I was fairly lucky with my dad. He may not have understood kind of the things that I was trying to transition on the farm and do, but he always gave me enough rope to hang myself, I guess. So he might not have understood it, but he let me go through it, and sometimes it worked out, sometimes it didn't. At his funeral a couple years ago, it was kind of a nice thing that one of the seed salesmen mentioned to me at the funeral, is that my dad, when the last time he had talked with him about buying seed, couldn't stop talking about how profitable one of my fields ended up being a few years ago, where I had organic barley on the field. Ended up yielding 90 bushel barley, and we ended up running cattle over the top of it. We ended up planting just at the right time, had a really nice cover crop on it, and we ended up grazing cattle on it for about a month afterward for feed. And my inputs were virtually nothing because I kept my own seed back, and there was no fertilizer besides running the cattle on top of it. And he never said it to me, but he must have said it to other people. He couldn't believe, you know, like, yeah, that was probably the most profitable land or profitable field that we had on all of our farms. And, you know, couldn't believe it, how well it worked with how little inputs. Now, it wasn't always that way, not every field, but it was, you know, it's nice to have those things happen. Getting back to what you're saying, the unfortunate thing I think I see now is that there's not enough of that older generation that's willing to let that younger generation take those chances and do those things. And with, even though we had, you know, farm income in 2022 was great, and 23 was really good as well. We're going to have a downturn in overall income in 24 with the prices the way that they've shifted. And that shift is going to put us back into a situation, and unless something happens, it's going to put us into a situation where margins are going to get thin again, and for operators. And we saw that after the 2011-12 run up in commodity prices. We had a step down through 13 and 14 through really 2020 were really tough on farmers, very thin margins. And so really taking those chances for something that a lot of them didn't want to do, because again, why would you put yourself in a situation where you could have a loss, and if there's not a lot of room to move around? And then additionally, if you know, and it's a lot of farmers are, you know, have to utilize credit to make their farming operations work. When it comes from a lender's standpoint, not saying that they're against any of the soil health or any of that by any means, but the one thing is, on a balance sheet, you're never going to find a line item that says soil organic matter. That's not going to matter. It might show up through your practices from being more profitable, but there's no line on that. And it's something that you have to build up over time. And so you need to have a little leeway in the front end, so that way you can make things going. You need to have that catalyst going forward. That's kind of the unfortunate thing, is that a lot of farmers don't have that option of being able to get, or young farmers don't have that option to get things started that way. If you can start on a small field and just do something different and just give it a try to see where it goes, I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of where it starts. But you have to have the ability to be able to do that. And if you can't start somewhere, you're never going to be able to get started anywhere. So.
One of the things you brought up repeatedly was, yeah, how you've had to deal with, there was a couple years of drought, now we had this weird, super wet early part of the season this year, where things kind of flipped. And one of the things you pointed out, which I think is a good point, that after a couple years of drought, you can tell people all you want that cover crops are a good idea. Boy, they have kind of a bad reputation right now, because people just couldn't get them established, and they didn't go well. So one of the things you brought up was, you would point out, you know, an example of where there was some issues with a piece of land that you were working with, and you'd say, boy, if I could get more perennials established here, I think that would really help me be more resilient on this piece of land and kind of be more flexible. That, it sounds like that's really the whole perennialization is something that you really think about and maybe are leaning more toward. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're leaning more towards on the farm in general.
Yeah, it's something I've thought about for a long time, and I just trying to make that cash flow, again, is kind of the difficult one. Just where I'm located, and a lot of that goes back to, you know, the cost of land. So in our area, we've had some land sales that were $14,000, $15,000 an acre. So land values are very high. Cash rent has been really high. I assume with commodity prices where they're at right now, they're going to come down. I am lucky. I'm farming some family land, so that makes it easier, but I still have to come up with cash rent. And when you make that conversion over to perennials, there's an investment. There's the investment of that first year, of whether you put a nurse crop on it, or if you're trying to take some hay off of it, it is not going to cash flow in that first year. So got one field this year that I've started in a perennial grass mix. It does have some legumes, some alfalfa in there. But this year, from an economic standpoint, I'm not going to be pulling off a lot from it. It's going to be a sink on the cash flow. Lucky the other fields are hopefully going to be covering that, like the organic wheat. It will help out to offset some of that, and that's kind of how I approach this. But going really back into those perennials, I look at some of the problems that I had, and a lot of them could have been solved from that, especially with adding more grasses to the mix. I have some alfalfa fields as well that were not supposed to be strictly alfalfa fields. Planting them in those droughts created a situation where the alfalfa took and the grasses didn't. And so the alfalfa, with its deep roots, was able to tap onto some moisture, and the grasses ended up withering and dying. And so these stands of alfalfa that I have were supposed to be a very diverse mix with grasses. That didn't come to be. That's prevented me from being able to graze them effectively, because of it's either having to be late season or very mature alfalfa, otherwise I'm going to have issues with bloat. And yes, I know there's ways to mitigate that, but at the end of the day, it doesn't necessarily mitigate all of the issues you have with that. So, but with the grasses, what that does is it gives me the option from a hay standpoint, and then also running the livestock. And I really, my first love, and I'd like to be the main, the prior primary enterprise on the farm is going to be the livestock. And with the sheep that we brought in, with the cattle, if I could run everything with cattle and sheep and or whatever other livestock and really take down the grain end of it, I'd much prefer that. But I have to be able to make that cash flow from a year-to-year basis. And so that's where those perennials, trying to fit in, figure out where those perennials come in. But if it rains too much, it's not a big deal with perennials because they're just going to suck up all the moisture. If you can't get out there to cut hay, not a big deal. You can go out and graze it. If it gets too dry, yes, that's unfortunate, but it's going to be dry anywhere. And then there's risk mitigation tools that are available if it gets too dry on grazing land. So you can utilize those too. It just gives you so many more options. And then also with the cover crops, I really do like adding in all of these cover crops. I like adding in these different plants, but if you're not going to get enough moisture to get growth out of them, and you're running those tractors and the equipment over the fields over and over again, there's a cost to that. And labor costs for repair costs on equipment aren't going down. The cost of equipment isn't going down. So if you can go into a perennial system, you can also limit a lot of that as well. From what I'm understanding from others I've talked to, quality of life might actually improve a little bit as well. There might be some free time instead of sitting on the seat of a tractor trying to get a cover crop in and making sure you have feed for cattle down the road. It's growing naturally that way. You're harvesting energy from the sun.
I can't get over a little bit the irony that you are farming in literally in the shadow of an ethanol plant, a major ethanol plant, which, not to beat up on ethanol, but it has played a major role in livestock being removed from the land in counties like Lyon County here, you know, where we're just, when an ethanol plant comes in, it's a big market for corn, and so there is, the fences come out, livestock leaves the area, and we don't see the integrated livestock crop farms anymore. You are kind of going, there's, you know, farmers all over who are going against the grain and trying to do things differently. You're doing it in the shadow of an ethanol plant, which is a big player in the trend the other way, where everything goes into row crops. I mean, do you ever think about the irony of that a little bit, of how you're really going against the grain?
Oh, yes. And in 2022, when there was $7 corn and I was out baling hay, absolutely. I would, as I turn the tractor around and see the ethanol plant on the, as I'm driving by, I'm questioning, what am I doing out here? I could be grazing corn. And I do raise corn as well. So, and most of my corn goes to the ethanol plant there, that because I try to raise my livestock as more of a grass-based system. I'm not feeding any corn to my livestock, so the corn that I do raise does go to the ethanol plant. I look at it from a diversity standpoint that, you know, it's good to have those options out there for individuals, but I think the key there is the diversity. Yes, ethanol is a part of agriculture, but this other part of agriculture, the grazing, the livestock end of it, that should also be a part of it as well. We need to, you know, just have a balance between the two. Yeah. So, but yes, that $7 corn made me just kind of grind my teeth together. What was I thinking? But now I think the local price right now is at $3.95, which, again, I teach a commodities class at SMSU, and in commodities class, we were looking over basis. The ethanol plant has risen the basis here. We have a stronger basis than a lot of the local communities. If you get 20, 30 miles away from here, the corn price could be 30 or 40 cents lower based on that. So it does have an economic bearing on the area, which in a positive way for grain farmers, but again, just need to be able to strike a balance on it. I can stomach baling hay a little bit better when I see the $3.95 as the price versus a north of $7. So.
For more on building soil health profitably and reintegrating livestock onto the land, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 357 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. It helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize.
And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.